Hello again, everyone. It's me, Jerry T. T for toast, as in dry toast, shaken, not stirred. Well, hello. Welcome back. Today, we're going to do the third session on climate change. It may end up being the final one. I don't know. I got a ton of stuff in front of me here. We'll see if we get through it all today. If we don't get through it all today, there will be a fourth episode. So, what else? Well, before I jump into it. Oh, yeah. So we had my niece's sweet 16. My niece Isabella had her sweet 16 this weekend. So happy birthday, Isabella. And I saw my sister-in-law and her brother, and he chatted with me briefly. So maybe we still might get that episode, which I'm really looking forward to, about them growing up in Chile during the time of Pinochet, when there was a lot of trouble and I guess revolution, and their father was one of the communist activists, and so their story of growing up in all this, and it would be really interesting to get a first world event of, you know, we live in, at least in North America here and most of Europe and that, we live in really almost sheltered lives. I hope it stays that way. Things are taking some interesting turns. But anyways, hopefully that'll come together. Anyways, let's carry on with climate change here. First thing I have to say is, remember, there's a ton of information. I just wanted to remind you, it's a wide-ranging topic. And the more I study it, the more information comes out, the more stuff there is, and I just can't keep up with it all. So I may jump around a bit in my presentation. It's just I'm sticking stuff in here and there as I find more information. So I apologize if it doesn't flow smoothly. Hopefully it will. But anyways, it might jump around a bit. And one correction, in the last episode, I had mentioned William Nordhaus, the only climate scientist to win a Nobel Prize. Correction, the only climate economist to win a Nobel Prize. A few scientists have won Nobels in climate. So one correction there. All right, let's dig into it. Let's get down the rabbit hole. So it seems like, as I mentioned, it seems like climate change articles, especially articles challenging the extremist view, are coming out almost daily. I'm seeing more and more new stuff. And I feel like I'm almost too late here with these episodes coming out, as it's just getting easier and easier to find better data on the issue. So once you've listened to the episodes, don't hesitate if you want to get out there and research it. There's a ton of information coming out and a lot of good stuff. I just can't keep up with it all. All right, enough said. So biologist Paul Ehrlich famously predicted in 1970 that the world would end by 1985. Now, I'm not sure, but I think he was wrong on that one, spectacularly wrong. Going out on a limb here on that one, but I think, therefore I am, and therefore the world is. Now, he basically said the world would no longer be able to sustain its populations, and that 1 to 2 billion people would die from starvation in the 1970s. And other so-called scientists jumped on board, predicting the end of the Earth within anywhere from 5 to 30 years. And Life magazine reported the same year, 1970, that city dwellers would have to walk around wearing gas masks because of the pollution. And if those of you that were around in the 1970s will remember, some of the big cities had some pretty bad pollution, real bad. Well, now because of better environmental regulations and inventions like the catalytic converter, our air is much cleaner. And I vaguely remember in the 70s and the 80s, corporate executives complaining loudly that they would never be able to meet these new regulations as they were coming out. And necessity being the mother of invention, sure enough, new technologies rose to meet the need and to fill the gap. And we'll talk more about new technologies as toward the end of the talk. Now, frankly, in my opinion, talk about irresponsible behavior. I mean, clearly he had no clear idea, had no rigorous data. I mean, he was wrong. He had no sound foundation to make such a terrifying claim and scaring the wits out of how many millions of people, maybe billions. And clearly the media that ran with the story should be ashamed of themselves. They certainly didn't do any source checking. Mind you, these days, they'd fit right in the pack. So thanks to them, some researchers actually considered adding chemicals to the water to sterilize the poor because of them bringing this out. And awfully, India sterilized, in 1976 alone, they sterilized 6.2 million men, and since have sterilized many, many women, and some have even died from the operation. So clearly these guys and their fear, the fear-mongering had really had some bad effects. Now, not having learned his lesson, in 1980, Ehrlich famously wagered business professor Julian Simon on resource scarcity. Ehrlich had stated that he would wager even money that England wouldn't even exist by the year 2000. And so Simon was all over that bet, and he challenged Ehrlich. He said, "You go ahead, you pick any commodity or resource you want, and we'll compare inflation-adjusted prices in 10 years." And Ehrlich actually picked five: copper, chromium, nickel, tin, and tungsten, all five of which were more plentiful and cheaper in 1990, not to mention many other resources. So Ehrlich lost the bet. And, you know, it's funny, as many losers of bets do, he wrote a book about how he would have been right if only things were different. He and others began picking different time periods and different resources and saying, well, if we had done it this way, I'd have won. Well, you know, you can't do that. You know, hindsight is always 20/20. You don't get to do that. You don't get to sit there and say, well, if the bet would have been different, you know, if this or that, you don't get to do that. Anyone can change the details after the fact to make things work in their favor. He even went back to 1950 to 1975, saying how the metals rose over that time period. Well, you knew that. You knew that in 1980 when you took the bet. So man up. You know, in 1980, him and Simon both would have known that. Clearly, Simon had a better vision of what 1980 to 1990 would hold. In 1950, he probably wouldn't have taken that bet. You know, and it's interesting, in researching it, one of the sources I went to was good old unbiased Wikipedia. And in mentioning the afterwards of the bet, they never mentioned any time periods that might have favored Simon. They only mentioned time periods that would have favored Ehrlich and the end of the world. And Ehrlich offered Simon another bet with numerous conditions. Now, Simon turned down the bet. And, you know, if you check out the details of the bet, I mean, a kid would have turned the bet down. Ehrlich picked a number of conditions that were almost for sure to occur. I mean, highly likely. And none of which, by the way, none of which were going to end the world. He just, I don't know, maybe sour grapes. Maybe he just wanted to win a bet. A few examples. He wanted to bet that between 1994 and 2004, that there would be more CO2 in the atmosphere. Well, duh. That there would be less fertile cropland per person. Well, duh. They're not making any more land, but they certainly are making more people. And it's interesting how we're going to find out he'd be sort of wrong on that one if more time was allowed, but we can't do that. And he also bet that there would be less available fire. He wanted to bet less available firewood per person in developing nations, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, those are all almost a fool's bet. So Simon could clearly see the setup, and he said, yeah, no. So he passed on that. Now, speaking of Paul Ehrlich and his food supply predictions, do you remember earlier, I think in the first episode it was, I mentioned the NASA scientist who predicted all these food systems collapsing simultaneously? Well, wasn't she wrong? Not only have our food systems not collapsed, but with technological advances, procedural advances, all kinds of advances, we're feeding more and more people with less and less farmland. And a new development that we're seeing in the real estate world is urban high-rise farming, where high-rise buildings are being converted into farms where they go vertical, where they're growing crops indoors on higher and higher levels. So it's interesting what technology can do and making the future brighter and brighter. And, you know, keeping along the same lines, I briefly alluded to this last episode, I think, about the current greening of the earth. So plants use CO2. CO2 is plant food. And they take it and they remove it from the atmosphere and they expire oxygen, and so they replenish oxygen. And well, with the Earth's rising CO2 levels, an area 1 to 2 times the size of the United States has greened over the last 150 years. That's right, the world has greened, and we are getting more, surprise, fertile land. We're feeding more people with less farmland as well, and so there's more and more green areas. The world's getting greener. And while we're on the topic of CO2 and famous people and this climate controversy, I want to talk for a few minutes about Patrick Moore. Does that name sound familiar to you? He was one of the founders, leaders of Greenpeace, and he's gone over to the dark side. He's on the evil side now. And so he mentions in one talk that there are over 100 climate models in use with these climate scientists. And I think it was Richard Lindzen, I think, another climate scientist in the bad guy camp. I think it was when he was speaking with Jordan Peterson. I think it was him. But they're talking about the well-known inaccuracies of the climate models and that they tend to err on the high side, on the disaster side. I don't know, they must have some built-in compounding errors, but they do tend to err on the high side as you go further and further into the future. He also mentions that prior to the industrial era, here's an interesting thing. Prior to the industrial era, so 150 years ago, give or take, CO2 levels were nearing the level at which no plant life would survive, which is kind of basically correct. Doing a little bit of research, which anybody can do, you'll find that around 150 to 200 parts per million, and I believe the level was around 280 parts per million before the industrial era, at around 150 to 200 parts per million, we're getting dangerously low with carbon dioxide for supporting plant life. And then 100 to 150 parts per million, few plant species could even survive. So he mentions that, hey, if anything, carbon dioxide is too low. He mentions that the recent carbon dioxide levels are among the lowest the Earth has ever seen, which is correct if you go back over the billions of years. Speaking of which, I finally got the pictures, the graphs, all the graphs up on the website, so go check it out, thefactofthematter.ca. You'll see the climate change page, and you'll see a bunch of graphs there, and I got the sources listed for you. There'll be more graphs coming after this podcast. I'm going to throw a few more graphs up there. Now, so he is correct that CO2 levels were, in recent years, among the lowest they've been in the 3 billion year history of the Earth. Now, that doesn't mean that higher CO2 levels won't have negative consequences. In fact, it's pretty much accepted that they will. But he's arguing that CO2 levels aren't too high. If anything, they're too low. So I don't know on that one. I'm a little skeptical on that. But he does make a good point that we were getting dangerously low there in the history of the Earth. So a bit of interesting information on Patrick Moore. Now, last episode, I got a little bit into forest fires. Now, I want to go down that rabbit hole for a few minutes and talk about forest fires. Now, I briefly mentioned that fire needs three things. Fire needs fuel, oxygen, and ignition, an ignition source. And so with the current greening of the Earth that I just talked about, we have a lot more forests nowadays. But also, environmentalists and environmental movements are making it more and more difficult to perform controlled burns. Controlled burns have been used for decades at least, and maybe even longer, maybe even back into the 1800s, even earlier maybe, where you take an area that's old and dry, dead, old growth forest, a lot of dead trees, a lot of dying trees. Those are at high risk of fire. And you just do a controlled burn on a good day when there's no wind or the wind is blowing the direction you want it to blow, and you've got everybody ready. You start a fire, you create some fire breaks, you put some safety things in place, and you burn an area. And so this way you get rid of this dangerous area. So that's the fuel. There's more fuel out there. There's far more fuel because the Earth is greened up, because we can't do controlled burns. Fire also needs oxygen, and oxygen's always been there, so there's nothing to say about that. It's just there. But the third thing it needs is an ignition source. And notice none of these have anything to do with the Earth being 1.2 or 1.1 or 1.3 degrees warmer than it was 150 years ago. If anything, the Earth has greened up. Well, we know it's greened up. It has greened up. It hasn't dried up, hasn't gotten browner. There are some areas that are browner, but overall, the Earth has greened up. The ignition source is increased by so many human beings, and we're going out and interacting with nature. We're causing the fires. We're maybe starting a forest fire, a campfire, and not putting it out, or doing things in the woods that create sparks. Human beings are the number one ignition source by far for forest fires, with lightning coming a distant second. But also, and here's a big one, more and more homes are being built in high-risk fire areas that weren't there many years ago. So we hear about all the damages that are being done. And I talked about this, I think, with floods and hurricanes, called the expanding bullseye, where, we're on forest fires, we'll talk forest fires. Let's say we have a forest fire 100 years ago that burned a certain 100 acres, and it burned the same 100 acres this year. Well, there's a lot more homes in that 100 acres, so the insurance damages, the dollar damages go up significantly. And also, in a lot of these reports, they're not being entirely honest in that they're not sometimes adjusting for inflation. So, statistically, there really isn't, over most of the Earth, an increase in fires other than an increase in fires from increased fires fuel source and increased human interaction. I speak of the devil. Everyone's probably thinking, hey, Toast, what about that fire in Maui we just had? Well, if you do a little research into the Maui fire, you find that, sure, there was a lot of dry wood, but those are probably old-growth forests. But also, people have introduced non-native grasses into the island. And if you know anything about grasses and grasslands, nothing spreads a fire like a grassland. Fire moves fast through grasslands. But also a lot of the steep terrain where the fire will climb the slope. And also lots of high winds in the area from passing hurricanes. So all the things for fire damage. And they've been warned. They've been warned for something like 10 years. And guess what they recommended? Controlled burns. They recommended thinning the vegetation near the population areas. Sadly, it wasn't carried out. So no doubt you're going to see the articles, oh, climate change. Well, do the research. Okay, so let's swing into interglacial warm periods. If you go into my website and if you look at the graphs I've posted there from the different sources, you'll see that two or maybe all three of the previous three interglacial warm periods, you'll see a graph over the last, I think it's something like every 100 to 125,000 years, there's an interglacial warm period, that the two or three of the previous ones were as warm or warmer than we are today. And all interglacials show a rapid warming trend, no different than our current one. And as just mentioned, they were warmer at their peaks than we were just a few years ago. Though in the last few years, we have carbon dioxide has been rising, and it's hard. You're going back so many years. It's really hard to get really, really accurate data. But comparing overall our interglacials that we're in right now to the other ones shows no really statistically significant, no discernible difference. And then when you look at the graph, I posted the graph going back throughout the history of the Earth, you'll see that throughout 90% of the Earth's history, carbon dioxide was significantly higher than it is now. Am I saying there's nothing to worry about? No, Tritos is not saying that. Don't get me on the denier camp. We're simply talking the facts here. And speaking of facts, in his great book, False Alarm, renowned and respected climate scientist Bjorn Lomborg takes a very logical and extremely evidence-based approach to climate change. And if you get into your own research, you'll find one thing. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the more activist side does tend to attack the less activist side personally. And they really want to go after Lomborg, but they can't. I mean, they do go after him, but his science, it's hard to attack his science. His research is so rock solid. And so you find, I haven't found anything other than vague accusations about cherry picking and this kind of thing, but I haven't found anything to back that up. Now, So a century ago, 100 years ago, 500,000 people died every year from extreme weather. Okay, 100 years ago, 500,000 people died every year from extreme weather. In 2021, with a monster heat dome, German floods, flash floods in Afghanistan, etc., less than 7,000 people died across the world, with four times the population of a century ago. What? Wait, what's going on? Wait, what did I toast? 500,000 people died from extreme weather 100 years ago. And you're telling me now with all this global warming and the end of the world, only 7,000 died in 2021. And that's not an abnormal number, by the way. Only 7,000 died from extreme weather with a population four times that of a century ago. Well, why is that? Because of our increased standard of living, which comes very much from fossil fuels. Basically, wealthier people can protect themselves better. We have more money. We have a better standard of living. Technology has advanced over the last century so much. We've invented products and techniques to protect us from the weather. Things like dikes. Holland is protected from the ocean with dikes. We have storm surge barriers. I mean, almost anyone can get air conditioning, at least in the Western world. But we're working on that, and hopefully more we'll be able to. And we will develop more and more technologies. So extreme heat is not the danger. Extreme cold certainly is, though. Headlines talk about all the heat deaths. You always read it every year, all the heat deaths. But cold deaths are something like 10 to 20 times every year of heat deaths. Cold is more of an issue than heat. And I think I talked about this in the first or second episode. When it's cold all winter, and you need to warm your house all winter. During a warm summer, you don't need to air condition every day. It's nice to, but you don't need to air condition every day, and you're not going to die if you don't air condition every day. You can go into the basement. There's a lot of things you can do. So anyways, extreme cold, even moderate cold kills more people than extreme cold. So cold seems to be more the enemy. Now, let's talk about the Great Barrier Reef for a few minutes. Headlines regularly decry the end of the Great Barrier Reef. Here's a becoming more and more well-known quote from the Spectator magazine, Australian edition, in 2022, and I quote, "The latest survey of the Great Barrier Reef by the Australian Institute of Marine Science, which was undertaken in May, reveals that coral cover has not only recovered, but across two-thirds of the reef, it is now at its highest level in 36 years of observations." End quote. So there's a quote on the oh my gosh, in trouble Great Barrier Reef. We talked about polar bears earlier when the statistics show their populations clearly steadily increasing since the 60s. So whatever climate change comes or is likely to come our way, it is highly likely that we can adapt to it. We are likely to come up with new technologies that will help. Cities are well known to be significantly warmer than the surrounding countryside. And models show that in cities, reducing the amount of black surfaces, all the roofs and asphalt paving and such, and adding water features, maybe in your yard, add a little water feature, maybe adding a green roof on a building, reducing the amount of black surfaces and adding water features and adding greenery could reduce heat wave temperatures by 18 degrees Fahrenheit. And that was under Lomborg. And that's incredible. And apparently it is incredibly cheap to simply add greenery and water features. So some pretty interesting, already some of the things that are coming out that we could do with relatively little cost. And, you know, and even if we managed to go net zero today, and if we could get to net zero today, which we can't, I mean, we don't have a hope, but even if we could get to net zero today and stayed net zero today, which would be a pretty ugly world, I'll tell you. We wouldn't have much of anything. We wouldn't be traveling anywhere, doing anything. World temperatures by 2050 would have only dropped 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And basically, you know, most of the troubling emissions are coming from the poorer world, China, Africa, India, Asia, South America, countries that want to be rich. And you know, they have a right. I mean, we sit here and we say, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that. Well, easy for us to say. You know, we are wealthy. We have all the things we need and we want. And so how can you blame anybody else for wanting the things that we have? And so they burn a lot of the fuel. They burn a lot of the carbon-producing fuels that are causing the carbon emissions. And we're going to talk about world carbon emissions actually in a little bit here. But I want to swing to the latest thing that in the fight against carbon emissions. The latest thing you've probably all heard of, the 15-minute cities. So the basic idea is designing cities so that everything we need is within a 15-minute drive, cycle, or walk from our home. Now, you know, on the surface, that's a great idea and would almost certainly reduce carbon emissions and would probably increase our health. As we walk and we cycle more, we're breathing cleaner air. So really, you know, the idea has a lot of merit. But when we think about it, though, a few other thoughts arise. First of all, you know, we're already doing a lot of this in North America, and we have been for years with some of the latest municipal designs. As cities have been growing and getting so big that they're becoming like exceptionally large, a concept that has been called the village concept, among other things, has been growing dramatically with buildings that contain main floor retail, and then above them they have numerous floors of multifamily housing. And so we're going up instead of out, and we're getting a lot more people in less area, and we're having you just go out to the main floor and your donut shop is there, and across the street there's your grocery store and such, and housing density has been increasing as a natural part of this. So much of what we need is already within 15 minutes, and I would argue always has been. It's just good design. So why the new concept? Well, and as many of you have already heard, some folks are arguing already for penalties for leaving your 15-minute zone, and there's a lot of the usual acrimonious political discussion over the 15-minute cities and people being called conspiracy theorists and all that, you know, the usual stuff. You can't have a logical argument, which is too bad because it's a really good idea. And so I did a little bit of a deep dive into this to see what I could find out. You know, is this a World Economic Forum trick to get, you know, to control us or, yeah, whatever. So I read a political article, and the creator of 15-minute cities, or I guess the designer, whoever, anyways, a Franco-Colombian academic, Carlos Moreno, spoke of those people who are against 15-minute cities. And you've got to read the article. Basically, I found it very, very biased, and I found it disturbing. So he's speaking against the people who are against 15-minute cities. And you can read the article. It's in Politico. And the detractors of 15-minute cities are, sure enough, the usual suspects, right-wing, far-right, fascist, and even the word insane, which brings up a separate but related issue that I talked about earlier, you know, that we just can't have rational debate. And I'm noticing that almost without exception, all the crises these days are being stirred up by the old media, and you're getting these strong biases. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but it is important, because we are seeing some of this in the climate debate, and you're getting more of the anti-conservative bias. And I've done informal reviews of news sites like our CBC here in Canada, and the anti-conservative bias to me seems very, very obvious. It's almost, there's no need to even analyze it. It's just evident. It's just on the surface evident. And every issue these days seems to be a left versus right, good versus evil argument. Just can't have a logical, which is too bad, because 15-minute cities is a really good idea. So in the article, everybody who's against the mainstream narrative is far right, alt right, fascist, which can lead to only one conclusion: who's behind this? The far right, the alt-right, fascist, misogynist, etc., 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 are enemies of whom? The far left. So anyway, reading further in the article, there is discreetly buried in one short paragraph in the middle is that the protesters are confusing the completely innocent 15-minute city plan with the totally unrelated but also completely innocent circulation plan. Isn't that a completely benign, innocent-sounding plan, the circulation plan, that directs traffic away from the city by creating quote-unquote discrete zones that can't be crossed by car and diverting them to the ring road? Well, what's the difference? What's the difference? If I want to go to my doctor by car and my doctor's in a discrete zone, I can't. I'm redirected away to the ring road. Ring roads are roads on the edges of cities. They bypass these cities. They don't go into the interior. And then the kiss of death is in the next paragraph when the author proudly declares that the plan is endorsed by the World Economic Forum and international organizations like C40 cities and progressive politicians. So there you go. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. What were we thinking? And he continues arguing that, ironically, people will get more freedom because they will spend less time going places, and that now most transportation is forced because of the distance. So he's saying most we're being forced to drive and to do transportation right now because of the distance. Well, he's right. That would free up some time. Great. It'll free up some time. Well, where will we go with this free time? Anywhere within 15 minutes, but you can't go outside of 15 minutes. So we have more freedom to wander our cages. Not done yet, he then trots out the obligatory one or two much smarter conservatives who have seen the light and who are embracing the 15-minute cities. But these are not far right, these are center-right conservatives. So the more you agree with the virtuous left, the more left you get to go. Maybe even get a little gold star on your good boy chart. So, reading the article, it got me wondering. I thought, my gosh, this is a real biased article. And so I went on to media bias fact check site, and it shows that Politico has a slight to moderate left bias with questionable sources. So anyways, interesting, which is too bad because I really like the idea of 15-minute cities. I really like, it goes back to, and I've talked about her before, Dr. Jane Jacobs, in her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she talks a lot about vibrant downtown cores. And so anyways, I hope this doesn't get derailed because of politics, but I also hope that it never gets used for bad purposes. Hopefully it gets only used for good purposes. All right. So let's talk about net zero for a bit. Net zero is starting to look, when you do the math on all the different the things they're recommending to get us to net zero, starting to look incredibly expensive and ineffective. It's a lot cheaper just to fund research on all the different promising technologies. And Bjorn Lomborg talks about this in his book, False Alarm. All the climate policies in the world won't change China or India or Africa, but if technologies are cheap and effective, they will. So, he makes the great point. I mean, the way we've always solved problems is by funding innovation. And, and that makes so much sense. Anytime the government says, I'm here to help, and you have to do this and you have to do that, it never works out. But anytime you simply make technologies that we need cheaper and more effective, people are happy to use them. So, interesting. So he basically talks about we shouldn't be forced to use some of these solar panels right now that aren't the most effective, and in 25 years you got this pile of junk you got to get rid of, and all across the world there's all these junk panels, and where do you put them? He said, let's just spend our money making better technologies, and when the better technologies come, then we can start to use them. We've never solved problems forcing people to do incredibly annoying things. I mean, how well did the COVID alarmist views go? How well did the lockdowns work? How many lives did they save? And how many did they cost through depression, suicide, delayed cancer treatments, delayed operations, etc. You know, all these facts are starting to come out that they probably did way more damage than good. How much did it cost our economies? How well did the school shutdowns work? The World Bank estimates that 1 billion kids are 9 months behind in their education. By 2040, when they're adults, that's just estimated to cost the world something like $1.2 trillion for things they could have done if they had been up to date or better educated. How well did the vaccines work? Who was hurt the most? I mean, any dissent was ruthlessly shut down, and they turned out to be right for the most part. So I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Bottom line, whenever the government forces us to do things, it never works as well. It was just innovate. Let's just innovate. So he makes good arguments with the climate change. Let's just innovate. You know, one thing is for certain in all this, whenever one side of a quote-unquote purely scientific issue uses alarmist arguments and grade 3 name-calling, you know something more is going on. You know there's an agenda. But hey, the alarmist side has Greta Thunberg. My gosh, they got Greta Thunberg. How could anyone not throw away their vehicles and go live in a cave? All right, I'll stop being a smarty pants. So let's get back to seriousness. So what to do? Well, the first thing you can do is relax. We're not going to die. The last 1.8 million years of Earth's existence, as I mentioned previously, are cooler than most of the previous 4,600 million. That's right, 4.6 billion. And you can see the graph on my website there. Also, there's significant evidence Earth's population will peak and decline in the foreseeable future. Most experts are in agreement on that. I know, Toasty, science is never settled. I know that. But the most experts at this point in time see that the Earth's population is going to peak soon and will start to decline. As we decline in population, less carbon emissions, right? In the U.S., peak logging deforestation was in 1990 and has been declining since. And as I mentioned, you know, the increasing forest cover has increased by one-third in the United States. Carbon emissions in many countries and, in fact, over the entire globe have been decreasing for years. And I'll put the graphs up on my website. There's a really great video you can watch, although he gets into all, it's not so much about climate change, it's about free thinking and free speech and free thought. But Michael Schellenberger recently gave a commencement talk to University of Austin students, and it was a really good talk. But he gets into a little bit of climate change, and basically countries like the U.S., Britain, and France, their carbon emissions peaked years ago and are continuing to decrease. And as I mentioned, global carbon emissions have also been decreasing already for years. So clearly, you know, we're improving how we do things. We're improving our technologies. We're working already on making the world a better place. We still have a lot of work to do. It's not over yet, but we're heading in the right direction. And remember, graphs of sea ice, of temperature, of hurricanes, etc., over any time period can be easily manipulated by what time period we pick. Basically, cherry picking the time period. So you got to be careful with any data you see, especially in the Earth. If you see something from 1980 to now, or from the last 100 years, that's chump change in the history of the Earth. And you have to say, okay, this looks concerning. Let's check a little further and see all the information. And speaking of Arctic sea ice, in my research here, I've seen different graphs of Arctic sea ice. Some, like the course I took, like the climate change course I took, show steady diminishing of Arctic ice, while others show no discernible reduction, including the National Sea and Ice Data Center. You can go to their website. I think it's just search for National Sea and Ice Data Center and you'll find it. And they showed that 2012 was the record low level. And you can click each year and you can watch each year the ice on this chart. And it seems to be, you know, I mean, there's natural variations every year, but overall seems to be steady. There was a graph recently, there was a podcast. I think it was Dr. Jordan Peterson or, oh no, it was a Twitter post. That's what it was. But I followed a couple links and it took me to a chart, and I wish I would have kept that chart. But it showed slightly increasing sea ice right up until the last couple of years ago, and the last couple of years it's been dropping. So that could be the start of something bad, or it could just be normal variation. But the point I'm getting at is overall, the Arctic sea ice seems to be overall rather stable over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Now, one of the things we hear a lot about, climate change, the sea rising, much of Bangladesh will be underwater because Bangladesh is very near or at sea level. Well, Michael Schellenberger talks about this. Already Holland is working with Bangladesh because Holland obviously is very good at keeping the sea away. They've got their own dikes. And so they're helping Holland, or they're helping Bangladesh, working with them already to start preparing just in case that does happen. And another thing we're hearing here in Canada, it's big. You probably heard about Holland. Speaking of Holland, you probably heard of the farmer protest last year where they were blocking highways and they actually got elected. They had their own party and most of their guys got elected. Where here in Canada, our lovely prime minister, and there in Holland, their lovely prime minister, were saying you've got to reduce fertilizer use by 30%. Well, as a matter of fact, in the U.S., peak fertilizer use was 23 years ago, 2000, and has been declining ever since. And farmers are business people. They have to buy fertilizer. They're not going to use an ounce more than they have to. They're very efficient. And Dutch farmers are, I don't know if you know this, but I believe Holland is the world's second largest exporter of food products, I believe. That little country of, little underwater country of Holland has huge, that's why all those farmers on the tractors got really, really mad, because that's a big part of their economy, and a lot of farmers' lives were at risk. And so, they become experts at making a living on farming, and I'm sure they don't use any more fertilizer than they have to, because clearly in the U.S. and probably other countries, fertilizer use has been declining. And our lovely prime minister here in Canada started recently backing off a little bit on that, saying, oh, well, it's going to be voluntary. So we'll see on that. You know, the bottom line is that fossil fuels are what has brought the world great prosperity. Energy is everything. Without energy, you're in trouble. We need energy. And fossil fuels are cheap, abundant energy sources. And ever since we learned about them and learned to harness them in a big way, we've seen the greatest economic growth the world has ever seen. Do we need to cut back on fossil fuels? Yeah, probably. Do we have to get to net zero by some time? Eh, probably. And even if we don't, well, we will. I mean, we will get there. You know, there's, as I mentioned in the first episode, there's so much excess sun energy. Someday we're going to learn to efficiently harness the sun. Right now, harnessing the sun and wind, we're not so good at that. Look what happened to Germany when Russia said, we're going to cut off the oil. So we're not there yet, but we'll get there. We'll get there. Will we one day have a world without fossil fuels? Probably. Do we need to do it by 2030? My gosh, I don't think so. The evidence I've found over these last few episodes doesn't lead me in that direction. And I mean, even still, we already have nuclear energy. And I know everyone gets scared of nuclear energy and we hear about all these disasters. But when we look back at the history of nuclear energy, how many nuclear plants there are, how much power it's produced, overall, it is very, very safe with very few problems. And again, like the one in Japan, you know, these are all tragedies. Anytime anybody loses their life, it's a tragedy. But it wasn't because of the nuclear energy, it's because where they built it. They built it in a higher risk place. And I don't mean to be flippant about it. But what I'm trying to say is nuclear energy is very safe and getting safer. Hopefully someday we'll have a better way. Maybe we'll get into nuclear fission instead of fusion instead of fission. And hopefully we'll get there. If we don't, we'll find something. So for the time being, we still have nuclear, and it's getting better and better and safer and safer. Now, of course, nuclear only provides power or electricity. It won't drive your vehicle unless we get a nuclear car. So speaking of which, technology continues to improve, and current vehicles and current appliances, for example, are much more efficient than when they first hit the markets in the 60s, 70s, whenever they first came out. And they will continue to improve. They're far more efficient, and they will continue to get more and more efficient. The farther you go, the farther you can see. As well, our energy production technology overall will continue to improve. You know, I just find it too convenient to blame, quote-unquote, big oil. You know, big oil. Doesn't that sound evil and sinister? There you go, big oil. So, you know, like, what exactly is big oil? What exactly? That's a vague, generic term. I mean, don't corporate executives care about their children as much as we do? I mean, sure, you know, they like their profits, but at some point, profits don't matter that much. And when your children's lives are at risk, profits don't seem to matter anymore. I'm sure the industry will do what it can to survive. I know the Canadian, the Alberta oil industry is getting better and better, some of the cleanest oil in the world for the bad rap it gets. Not only clean, but ethical oil, people being paid well, living well. So I don't think quote-unquote big oil executives are any more sinister than big alternative energy executives. I mean, we've spent a ton of money into energy efficiency, billions and maybe even trillions have been poured into it with really nothing to show for it yet. You know, if anything, big, quote-unquote, big government strikes me as the real concern here. I mean, we have all these virtue signaling world leaders taking private jets to Davos, staying in luxurious surroundings. I mean, they're burning fossil fuel every step of the way while warning us we have to cut back. And they somehow fail to mention that, as I mentioned earlier, gee, global carbon emissions have been declining for years. Things are getting better. There's so many good things. So I know I've wandered all over with this, hopefully, and I've tried to keep it from getting too science-y language. I've tried to keep it simple language that we can all relate to. But, you know, bottom line, let's just do what we reasonably can. Yard by yard, things are hard, but inch by inch, it's a cinch. I know in 2011, we moved closer to work and closer to family members so that we don't travel anywhere near as much as we used to. I started cycling and walking more. We reduce, reuse, recycle as much as possible, although I've heard some things that recycling is maybe a bit of a not as effective as we're led to believe, but that's another day. You know, collect rainwater. We started collecting rainwater. We use rainwater around the yard. We dry our clothes now on an outdoor rack in the summertime and indoor in the wintertime instead of using the dryer. And in the summertime, you get that fresh air on the clothes and you're saving energy and you're not overheating the home in summertime. So we dry clothes on a rack outdoor in the summer and indoor in the winter. Believe me, that summer fresh air, the clothes smell amazing and we're saving energy. We have a big house. We have a bigger house than we should. And you know, we just use a window air conditioner on the hot summer days. And so it doesn't cool the entire house, you know, to like 19, 20 degrees. But you know, it cuts the heat enough that we can sleep or reasonably comfortable. So we just use a little window air conditioner instead of a big one to cool the whole home. And we close our blinds on the sunward side of the house during warm days. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you can reduce the black surfaces, plant a tree, get water features. There's so many different things we can do. And, you know, just keep an eye on new technologies. More and more technologies will be coming out. They'll keep coming out over the years, and things will get better and better. We're not going to die. The future is bright for me and for you. And so that's where I want to wrap it up. It looks like this will be my last episode. I got everything I wanted to say done. I wasn't sure I'd get it all done, and I got it said in less than an hour. So that's pretty amazing. So there we go, folks. So there's the bottom line. I don't think, from all the evidence I've seen, I don't think there's a climate emergency. Do we need to do stuff? Yeah. You know, carbon dioxide levels are going up, and it's almost indisputable that we are a big cause of that. Carbon dioxide levels might keep going up a couple hundred more. It might be no problem whatsoever, but there might be. We don't know. And, you know, you don't want unintended consequences. So I guess do what we can, and things will work themselves out. The best climate models show that, you know, even if we don't make much difference, by 2100, we will, if you remember, we'll only be 3 or 4% less rich. And we're supposed to be like 350 to 400% richer in 100 years from, or by 2100. So we'll, instead of being 380% richer, we'll be 376. And remember, all the virtue signaling, you know, about, oh, climate is going to affect the world's poor. Well, climate change policies will affect the world's poor even more. And I don't think we have any basis to stand on a soapbox and say to the world's poor, you can't have what we have. You have to cut back. I think shame on us if we say that. If our world has to get a little warmer and theirs gets a little better, well, you know, maybe that's something that we just have to live with. We've had good lives in the Western world, and everyone deserves a good life. And, you know, everyone only gets one life. And for a child to grow up poor with no chance of a good life, no chance of traveling like we travel, seeing the things we see, eating the wonderful foods we eat, living the life we live, you know what? If my life has to get a degree warmer over the next 100 years, well, then so be it, I guess. So there's my, I'll get off my soapbox here. There's my, that ends a session on climate change. The world's not going to end. We're going to be okay, but let's not rest on our laurels. Let's keep doing what we reasonably can, and let's make the world a better place for me and for you. That's it, folks. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.